So how are your peepers doing? We are going to get an eye exam this hour, and our guest eye doctor will see how he can help us preserve our vision and answer your questions about eye care. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, September 16th. It's been about a year since our last show on eye care, and I remember it well because it was around the time that I had a partial retina detachment and another tear in my right retina. All is well for me right now, at least I hope so. How about you? Are you among the 25 million people over the age of 40 with cataracts, or the 2.5 million who have glaucoma, or 2 million with age-related macular degeneration? Or you find yourself now in the need of reading glasses or bifocals? You can join us with your eye care questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Dr. Dan Kanak. He is an ophthalmologist at UW Health and an assistant professor of ophthalmology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for being here.
You know, thank you.
There really wasn't a news peg, so to speak, to do this show, but I'm going to lift the veil, so to speak. Bill Martins, he is the producer of this show. He had to go to the eye doctor the other day. He's not even 40 yet, but he started noticing that he wasn't seeing as well. And how common is that? Do we all just lose vision or start having vision problems as we age?
Well, the about 40, we start to realize that we don't see as well up close. So that's a normal, natural process that the lens goes through. Basically, when we're born, our natural lens, it's very malleable. It changes shape. You can focus in the distance. You can focus up close. But unfortunately, as we get more and more birthdays, which all humans do, what happens is the lens starts to get a little bit more, it's not as malleable, and it doesn't change as well. So in about our 40s, we start to realize we don't see as good up close. And then usually it's just a reading glasses issue. But that's a great time to get your eyes looked at, get a good dilated exam to make sure that you don't have some of the other diseases that start to creep up as well.
How often should we go see an eye doctor?
When we're younger, it's probably okay to do it about every 3 to 5 years or so. Get a good baseline exam with a dilation. That's the main thing. Because even when we're younger, you can certainly get diseases, even some of the diseases that we see in older folks, such as glaucoma. And then if your eyes are pretty healthy between the ages of 30 to about 50, every about 3 to 5 years would be fine. And then as we get closer to the age of 65, we start to talk about every couple of years. And then at 65, really, it should be once a year.
I think I'm going once a year now because of that retinal or partial retina detachment. The last time I went, all was well. The laser surgery was holding well. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was given an almost clean bill of health, except that the ophthalmologist mentioned to me that there was the start of a cataract. She was seeing the start of a cataract. How sad should I be about that?
First off, I am so glad that you're doing well. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that you did the right thing. You were having issues and you called. That was very important. So to answer your question, cataracts are normal and natural. I tell all my patients that if you're a human and you have birthdays, you're going to get a cataract. So we tell people they have cataracts typically in their 50s is when it starts, but typically we don't have to take them out until they're about 60, 65, because what happens is the natural lens starts to get cloudy. That's really what a cataract is. And just because you have a cataract doesn't mean you have to do anything. Because lots of times it'll change the prescription. You can fix that with glasses. And then once it becomes visually significant, you might notice things like glare, halos at nighttime, or you might feel overall that you can't see as well as you would like to read, drive. And when it really starts to affect your activities of daily living, as we call it, then it's time to consider cataract surgery. But typically that's a visual acuity issue of about 20/40, or that could be to the point that it's really affecting your driving and those kind of things.
I've seen a little of those halos, so that's the cataract.
That is the cataract talking.
All right. Well, I was advised to be sure to wear sunglasses because that helps prevent the development or the progression.
Mm-hmm. So there's many things that can cause development of cataracts and progression. Lots and lots of more data, I believe, is kind of coming out that's saying environmental factors such as UV light can do that. That's why the sunglasses are important. UV light, if you look at your sunglasses, they should be UVA and UVB, 100% blockage. That can be helpful. And then, of course, other things in our environment, like medications, can increase the risk of cataracts, such as steroids, those kind of things. Trauma can increase the progression of cataracts. And even diseases like having diabetes can make cataracts grow quicker.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know a lot about cataracts. We called you last week to set up this show, and you couldn't do it because you were doing a lot of cataract surgery. So tell us a little bit about how advanced cataract surgery is today as compared to maybe back in our parents' day.
Sure. So even going back a little bit further, cataract surgery has come, you know, a long way. If you think about, you know, the word cataract, it really comes from the Latin word cataracta, because prior to 1700, people looked at people with cataracts and kind of thought that there was this opaque material that was flowing behind the patient's eye that looked like a waterfall. Cataracts really are like we talked about. It's basically a natural process where the lens changes. The protein content in the lens starts to change, and then you start to see whitening of the natural lens, yellowing, and then eventually it can get to the point that affects vision. The first cataract surgery was done way back in the 6th century BC in India, and a surgeon there decided that it might be a good idea to help push that cataract out of the way with a big stick.
I'm glad I don't live in 6th century India.
Yes. I can imagine that was very exciting for that first patient. Probably very exciting that they could see, but unfortunately, eventually the eye becomes very inflammatory if you do that, and then they lose all sight. So short-term, okay. Long-term, not so good. Things kind of went along until about 29 AD, and then they decided that maybe we can break up the lens into small pieces, which was actually a great idea. That's what we do now. But that, unfortunately, was done with a needle. And again, the same thing. They could see for a little bit, and then the eye would become inflammatory, and they would lose all sight. The modern era cataract surgery started somewhere about 1750 or so in Paris, where the first extracap surgery was done. Extracapsular surgery basically means what we do today, where we break up the lens into small pieces, take them out of the eye. So that was a huge change. Instead of leaving the lens inside of the eye, the lens came out, which helped decrease the risk of inflammation and loss of sight. And the unfortunate thing is, even though they had the concept correct, general anesthesia wasn't around until really about 1840. So you can imagine those first patients had lots of pain. There's all these drawings of where they would hold down their patients. So that wasn't quite what we wanted. So they kind of had the concept of the surgery down, but the other part of the surgery that was very important was really figuring out how to put the lens inside of the eye. Because you can take the lens out, but if you don't put a lens in, then you're going to have really thick glasses, and that's just no fun. When World War II came around, a gentleman in Britain actually realized that he found all of his patients coming back who were pilots and had canopy inside of their eye. And he realized that this canopy was inert, so the canopy from the cockpits, and he decided that maybe I can put a power on that lens, put it inside of the eye so these people can have surgery and also have a lens implanted at the same time. His name was Harold Ridley. He was ridiculed like crazy, but eventually he was knighted, and he was totally correct. So he kind of finished, if you would, the cataract surgery, taking out the lens, putting the lens in. More recently, lots of advances actually in the U.S. happened that helped push cataract surgery into the modern realm. In 1967, there was a doctor, Dr. Kelman, that decided that maybe instead of taking scalpels and taking the lens out in one piece or breaking it up with a needle, maybe we can actually make a small incision, insert a handpiece that has ultrasound on it, and break up the lens into very small parts. And his name was Dr. Kelman. There was also then the development of foldable lenses in the 1980s, and modern cataract surgery as the way it's done now with topical anesthesia, where the patient is alert, awake during the surgery. That was actually first done in 1993 by Dr. Fishman. He was also a United States doctor, so really everything has come around only about the last 20 years, where now we do it the way we do it.
Yeah, and now they are starting to do cataract surgery with lasers?
They are. So although cataract surgery has come a long way, and we can do surgeries typically in 10 to 15 minutes, those kind of things, we always are looking for advances. That's why I love ophthalmology. There's more specialized lenses trying to get people out of glasses more that fix astigmatism, that try to act more like the natural lens. And then, like you asked about, there's lasers now that can be used to break up the cataract. The lasers for the cataract surgery are not quite in everyone's office. There is one at the VA hospital here in Madison, but it's one of those things that eventually that will probably become mainstream, but it's not quite there yet.
We are talking with Dr. Dan Knock. He is an ophthalmologist at UW Health, an assistant professor of ophthalmology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And we are welcoming your questions about all things eye-related. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Do you have a question about your eyes or eye care? What about treatment for an eye disease or eye injury? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine talking about all things eye-related with our guest ophthalmologist, and our first caller is Diane in Madison. Hi, Diane. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to give testimony to the fact that I have had two very, very successful cataract surgeries. I had one in November and this last one in June. Mm-hmm. And I cannot begin to tell you what a wonderful decision it was for me. It was told by my ophthalmologist, and I also knew I couldn't see well. Everything was blurry. Every time I rubbed my eye, I felt like I wanted that to be out of my eye, mm-hmm. the lens. And now I have 20/20 vision. I barely need to use glasses any longer, and it's the best thing that's come along in ages for me.
I'm glad, Diane. Thank you so much for that testimonial. So maybe I should just have that right now.
No. Not yet.
Yeah, yeah. So we also have another another cataract question from Maddie in Wapaka. Hi, Maddie.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to know what the doctor thinks of the special lens that has a bifocal in it, so you can see in the distance and up close. And if he give any estimate of price ranges for that kind of surgery.
Mm-hmm. So what you're talking about is a multifocal lens. So when you think about cataract surgery, the tried and true way that's covered by insurance in regards to the lens insertion part is basically a single vision lens. Most people like to be set up for the distance, and then you would still need reading glasses and sometimes even glasses to fine tune things. What you're asking about is the specialized type lenses, which unfortunately is not covered by insurance. A multifocal lens tries to get at distance as well as for reading. How they work is they have little tiny concentric rings. So when you have a big bright light, your pupil comes down and then the light focuses through the central ring. They're very useful for many patients. The downside of these types of lenses is certain patients really don't like them. For example, a pilot who's flying a plane at nighttime might have a lot of aberration because the pupil gets a little bit bigger and they're starting to catch the edge of the rings on the outside. However, someone whose day-to-day activities don't require that type of precision with their vision, it can be a very useful tool. What kind of hobbies, those kind of things, do you like to do?
Maddie?
I don't do any close hobbies anymore.
Mm-hmm. Do you do anything that you need really precise vision? Are you driving a lot at nighttime, far distance, those kind of things?
Yes, sometimes I do drive at nighttime.
Okay. One thing to understand about these lenses is the downside of the lens is you might notice more aberration. So your physician, when you're thinking about these types of lenses, can talk to you about that. You'll notice things more like a little bit of blur at the edges when you're driving. If you can tolerate that and that's important to you to be able to see in the distance and near with less dependence on glasses, then it might be a good trade-off. Do remember that these types of lenses aren't perfect. We're always working towards better technology, and that really even if everything goes perfect, you still might be in glasses about 5-10% of the time. And the other thing to understand is that sometimes you will have astigmatism that will have to be addressed at the time of surgery as well. And that can be additional surgeries such as LASIK, those kind of things.
Good luck to you, Maddie. So, do you have a generally how much that kind of a typical cataract surgery costs?
Well, the cataract surgery itself, even if you went with a premium lens, is still covered by insurance.
Mm-hmm.
The lenses that are the out-of-pocket cost for some of the premium lenses, that can range anywhere between $1,000 to $2,000 per eye. I luckily don't have to set those prices.
Yeah, right. It's not up to you. There is a Facebook question from someone who wants to know if anyone offers free or low-cost eye care. This person is from Milwaukee, but I know you're familiar with Madison.
Yep. So, you know, all of us going in ophthalmology, a lot of us have done international work, those kind of things. I went to the Philippines, did international work. And actually, Madison does have a community clinic where people who are of low income, those kind of things, usually get referred to by their primary care provider. And that typically happens about once a month. And that's something that they can get either locally. If they're from Milwaukee, I'm sure there's something through one of the local schools there, those kind of things.
Well, we have, we'll go off the topic of cataracts just momentarily anyway. We have Kathy in Watertown with us. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you.
Hello.
I wonder if you could address floaters. I've had floaters in both eyes since May. I did go to see my eye doctor because I was very concerned. Mm-hmm. And basically, I'm told I have to live with them. But I'm not quite sure why they don't break down and go away. And I wonder if there's absolutely any hope of this going away. It doesn't interfere with driving or anything like that. But it is quite annoying. And I wonder if you could just speak to the subject of what appear to be permanent floaters. And I would take my answer off the air.
Before you go, Kathy, because I've had them, do you consider your floater a stringy thing or a spot?
I have both. I have little, like little threads, little strings, and I also have little spots.
Yep.
So I've got both.
Okay.
Good. So I'm glad you went in. That's the most important thing. So floaters are pretty much something that happens to all of us. Now, when we first get a floater, if you imagine there's a jelly in the back of the eye called the vitreous. This is not really like a jelly. It's more like a scaffolding system where there's a bunch of these little sticky hands that are holding on to the inside of the eye. As we get birthdays or if we're very nearsighted, everything is on stretch. And then there's water in this vitreous, so that vitreous then shrinks. When that vitreous shrinks, it starts to contract on the retina, and then you can first notice flashes of light. Those flashes of light can then move on to become a floater as that vitreous peels off from where it belongs. When it peels off from where it belongs, it starts to float around, and you can notice a shadow in your vision, and you see that as a floater. It's very important when you get a floater to go in to get it looked at, because once in a while, you can have a retinal tear, and those tears need to be addressed and addressed quickly. So anytime you have a new floater, especially if you have a lot of flashes of light with the floater or shower floaters, it should be looked at. Now, to get at the second part of your question, the common question is, what should I do? Now, when you think about floaters, it is a natural process that the eye goes through. So because it's a natural entity inside of the eye doesn't really break down that vitreous over time. Luckily, your brain will start to, as the months go on, realize that it's nothing important to worry about. So typically, you will notice the floater a lot less. There are certain technologies that can be done to help decrease the floater. There can be a laser done to break up the floater. I really am not a big proponent of that because instead of having one large annoying floater, you might now have 100 annoying floaters. And once the laser's done, you can't really go back. Once in a great while, if someone's floater is really bothersome, surgery could be done. But again, I would not want to do surgery on an eye that's seeing well. Most of the time, people can get used to their floaters.
Yeah, thanks very much for that call. A caller who was too shy to go on the air, but wanted to know more about floaters. She says that she has resorted to standing on her head to try to get rid of them. Would that get rid of a floater?
As hard as that sounds, I mean, there is some sense because, I mean, not that I would advocate standing on your head all day, but basically the floater truly does float around. It's where the jelly starts to move around inside of your eye. So when you have a floater, you can flick your eye pretty quickly to the right, to the left, up, down, and make it move out of the way. So if you were driving and it was getting annoying, you can try to flick your eye to get it out of the way. So I do understand what she's getting at.
Yeah. What happened when I was seeing floaters, what I was seeing actually were a lot of spots. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that what I was seeing was the red blood cell because I did experience the retinal tear.
Yep. So that's an ominous sign. So floaters themselves are pretty common. Even if you have a new floater, I would get it checked out just to be safe. But when you have hundreds of floaters or lots of floaters, typically it's not just the jelly you're seeing, but you're actually seeing little tiny pinpricks, and that's actually red blood cells that are now floating in your vitreous. So that shower floaters or lots of flashes of light, it was really good that you would enjoy.
Yeah, and it, a laser took care of it, mended it, and all is well. You know, maybe we have time for Nancy in Milwaukee before our news break. Hi, Nancy.
Hello.
Hi.
For many years, I took an over-the-counter drug called diphenhydramine hydrochloride, and I took this to help me go to sleep at night, although I took a very minimal dose, usually half of a 25-milligram pill, and it proved to be very successful in putting me to sleep. Mm-hmm. But this is a drug that's also sold to dry up people's sinuses, and when I realized that, I asked the pharmacist if this in any way could damage any other part of the body, because if it's drying up sinuses, it's also possibly drying up the cilia in the interior of the ear and anything in your eye, which is mostly liquid. And he said, no, it's a perfectly safe drug. But now, at the age of 81, I have been determined to have glaucoma.
Well, hold on, Nancy. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that this question was going to be as maybe complicated as it is. We have news that we will check, and then when we come back, we'll pick up on your question. I'm Joy Cardine. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network. I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. We are talking about eye care this hour and preserving our vision, especially as we grow older. According to AARP, among people 40 and older, 25 million have cataracts, 2.5 million have glaucoma. More than 2 million have age-related macular degeneration. We're talking about what we can do about these eye conditions, and our guest is answering your eye-related questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. It is now 6:37 on this Monday, September 16th. Our guest is Dan Kanak, Doctor of Ophthalmology at UW Health and an assistant professor of ophthalmology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Our number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. At news time, we were talking with Nancy from Milwaukee, who was talking about, I think you were leading to glaucoma, Nancy.
Yes. I had been taking for very many years an over-the-counter drug called diphenhydramine hydrochloride. I took a half of a 25-milligram tablet. And my question is, when I realized that this was a drug that also people took to dry up their sinuses, it occurred to me to ask the pharmacist whether this could be harmful in terms of the cilia in your inner ear or in the eye, which is mostly liquid. And he said at that time, oh, no, this is a perfectly safe drug. But now at the age of 81... I've been determined to have glaucoma, and I'm wondering if this is not a drug that actually participated in the formation of my glaucoma.
So that's a great question. So two parts to your question. So diphenhydramine, which is commonly known as the brand name Benadryl, you know, common medicine for allergies, common medicine for sleep aid, those kind of things. So the first part of your question, dry eye. Dry eye is something that happens to a lot of us. I have dry eye as well. Diphenhydramine, basically how it works to help you sleep is it blocks a certain receptor called the cholinergic receptor. It's not perfect about that, so it also actually decreases the amount of tear production that people make, so it can certainly make dry eye worse. Now, it would never make you to the point where it causes pathological dry eye, but it can certainly make dry eye worse if you have it. The other part of your question gets at glaucoma. Glaucoma has two different types. There's a angle closure type, and there's an open angle type. Have you been determined to have open angle glaucoma that needs chronic monitoring and not really surgery, but drops, those kind of things?
Yes, I am taking a drop called latanoprost.
Okay, so that's used to treat open angle glaucoma. So when you think about diphenhydramine, like we were talking about earlier, it's not perfect at blocking just the receptor it wants. And what it can do is actually it can cause slight dilation of the pupil. So we worry about it more in people who have the angle closure type. That type of glaucoma, the best way to think about it is if you have a one-bedroom apartment and try to fit six couches in there, it just doesn't all fit. So that can be determined by a quick exam in the ophthalmologist's office, which has probably already been done for you. So let your ophthalmologist know that you're on the diphenhydramine, but if you don't have angle closure glaucoma or are susceptible to it, diphenhydramine is perfectly fine for that. For someone who has open angle glaucoma, there is no contraindication of diphenhydramine for that at all.
Now, exactly what is glaucoma?
That's an excellent question. So glaucoma is unfortunately one of those silent diseases. Like you said, there's millions of people out there with glaucoma. The open angle glaucoma, basically no one really knows exactly what causes it. We thought that it was an optic nerve issue, but now more and more data is pointing towards more of a primary retinal issue. But basically what happens is we start to see changes in the optic nerve. I always like to think about our optic nerve. It looks like a donut. There's a little donut hole in the middle. And that donut hole in glaucoma gets bigger and bigger with time because the optic nerve is slowly dying off. What we realize is that the one thing that helps decrease the rate of progression of glaucoma, because it's only treatable, it's not curable, is decreasing the eye pressure. Mm-hmm. And like Nancy was saying, she takes latanoprost because that actually helps the fluid leave the eye.
All right. So does the use of Benadryl lead to glaucoma?
No. So to answer her question, there is no correlation between her long use of diphenhydramine and open-angle glaucoma. There's nothing in the data that says that.
But it can lead to some dry eye.
Can lead to dry eye for sure. And someone who's susceptible to angle closure glaucoma, that's why really the precaution is on the label sometimes for many of those medicines.
Uh-huh. Now, dry eye, is that something fairly common, or is that just something that happens too when you get older?
It's extremely common. Mm-hmm. And this has been a bad year for dry eye sufferers. So things that make dry eye worse are certain medications, like Nancy's asking about, like the diphenhydramines. Other things that can do that are environmental. So, for example, us having hot weather in the past, fans, ceiling fans can do that. Environment can do that. And then really the mainstay of therapy is artificial tears. And if tears a couple times a day don't work, then I would definitely see your eye care provider because other things can be done.
Yeah, that was another thing that was recommended to me was just an over-the-counter artificial tear.
Yes, that's perfect. The brand doesn't really matter as long as you do it every day.
Thank you, Nancy. Good luck to you. Betty in Independence is with us now. Hi, Betty.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. What's your issue?
I have the dry macular degeneration. And I have been in a study for the past year through Novartis, and I've been getting injections in my eye. And the last time I was there, my ophthalmologist approached me, and he said, I would be a good candidate for getting a telescopic lens replacement. What does a doctor think about this?
Yep. Now, you were getting injections. Do you know the medication you were getting injected?
No, it's a blind study at this time. I've been in it for a year, and now they extended it for another 6 months, so I still don't know what it is, whether I'm getting the sham medication or the real one.
Yep, good. The sham, yes, the non-medication. So, you know, most of the time when you're treated for macular degeneration, you actually have the wet type of macular degeneration. So why don't we talk just a little bit for the listeners. So there's two different types of macular degeneration. There's dry and there's wet. The dry macular degeneration is... When I think about macular degeneration, think about the eye like a nuclear power plant. There's so much going on. There's so much energy that's needed, but there's waste products that build up. Deep in the eye, those structures actually help recycle those waste products, but in macular degeneration, it just doesn't work like it should. Those waste products build up, and we see that as drusen is what we call them, little tiny yellow things in the back of the eye. That's the classic dry macular degeneration, and that gets worse as the years go on, but typically not overnight. Wet macular degeneration happens because the blood vessels in the back of the eye can then break, and then all of a sudden you can have where the vision changes. Injections inside of the eye really get at mainly the wet type of macular degeneration, because what they do is they help block those blood vessels from proliferating. So that sounds more like the wet macular degeneration and those kind of things.
Now, but Betty was saying that she was a candidate for some sort of surgery.
The telescopic lens. Mm-hmm. So when you think about macular degeneration, unfortunately what happens is the central vision starts to go away. It's very different than glaucoma where the peripheral vision goes away. So unfortunately people can't see faces, those kind of things. So what the thought process is maybe you can take one of the eyes that doesn't see centrally and put in a telescope. A telescopic lens basically gives you lots of magnification. They would only do it in one eye. They're starting to become more common in therapy, but typically they would be implanted by a cornea specialist, those kind of things. And it's one of those things that hasn't quite caught on, but I think for the right patient, it can be very beneficial.
Thank you for the call, Betty. Jana on Facebook says, I have a family history of macular degeneration with onset in the early 60s. Is there anything you can do to prevent getting it?
That is another excellent question. So macular degeneration is familial. It's not genetic in regards to things like blonde hair or blue eyes where you can say this amount of your children will have it, but it does run in families. So things you can do to help prevent that is you can take certain supplements, vitamins, those kind of things. If you don't have macular degeneration, you don't necessarily have to. The best thing you can do is actually what we call a rainbow diet. So have greens and reds and yellows and purples. Mm-hmm. If you're doing that, you're getting everything that you need. Lutein is a great supplement to consider if you are going to consider taking a supplement. Not smoking is very important. Wearing sunglasses is very important. Those kind of things. But, of course, get your eyes looked at. Make sure where you stand.
Let's go next to Patty in West Bend. Hello, Patty.
Good morning. I had LASIK surgery about 20 years ago, and it was just in the tail end of the FDA trials.
Mm-hmm.
Bad astigmatism, 2400 uncorrected.
Mm-hmm.
And I came out of surgery with 2015 and 2020 vision and could not have been happier ever.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I'm pushing 50, the vision nearsightedness issue or whatever, I need reading glasses. But I'm at the point now where they actually want me in bifocals, and I'm wondering if there's any way to just go back and tweak the LASIKs because I got really spoiled.
Yes, you got used to perfect vision. So LASIK surgery, how that works is it basically changes how the light goes through the front of the eye, the cornea. If you think about it, you were probably very nearsighted with your astigmatism, and what happened is the LASIK energy changed how the cornea was shaped. Now, one of a couple of things is happening. Number one, you should get a good eye exam because once in a while the cornea can get a little bit too thin. That's very uncommon but important to rule out in your care. More commonly, as we start to get into our 50s or close to 50, as you said, you can start to get the very earliest signs of cataract, which has a tendency to change how the light goes through the lens. And as that cataract changes how the light goes through the lens, it can change your prescription. So I would get that looked at first. If everything looks perfect, you can certainly always talk to your LASIK surgeon to see if you need what's called an enhancement. And one final thing to recommend is anyone who has had LASIK surgery, make sure that you get all of your records. Because let's say you are developing a cataract and within the next several years need cataract surgery, we need to pick the proper lens to put inside of your eye at the time of cataract surgery. And your LASIK records are so helpful to make sure that proper lens is put in.
Yeah. How common is it if you would have LASIK surgery to correct nearsightedness that you will start becoming nearsighted again?
It's not uncommon. It's one of those things that, is commonly talked about at the time of LASIK surgery, where things do start to get a little bit worse as time goes on. The classic time is about when you're 50, when the cataract starts to change things.
Patty, thanks for the call. Good luck. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Dr. Dan Kanak. He is an ophthalmologist at UW Health, an assistant professor of ophthalmology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And we are talking about your vision and answering your questions about eye care, conditions, and treatment. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, and we are talking all things eye-related and welcoming your questions for our guest ophthalmologist at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Mike emails, at my last visit to the eye doctor, I was told I have high ocular pressure in one eye. It was suggested that I have a checkup yearly to monitor this pressure. The doctor was very vague about why this could happen and what I could do to help this condition besides the yearly checkups. Would your guest have any more information on ocular pressure?
Sure. So first off, anytime you have questions, feel free to call your eye care provider. I love good communication with my patients. Mm-hmm. I want them to understand why they're coming in and what's going on. So feel free to talk to your provider just to be sure what's going on. What your question gets at really is high eye pressure can be an indication of glaucoma. Like we talked about earlier, glaucoma can be a disease that's a little bit more quiet and you don't notice it until you go into the eye doctor. So if your eye pressure is high, you can have changes of the optic nerve leading to glaucoma. So we like to make sure that the eye pressure is in that nice, stable range when you come in.
So the yearly checkups are to make sure that that it's not changing drastically.
Yes, and having high eye pressure in one eye and not both does make you a little bit more concerned.
Why?
Because if it's asymmetric, you would think that there's people out there that basically have high eye pressure. One good reason why is if the outside layer of the eye, the cornea, is thick, it takes a little bit more effort just to push through the cornea to get an eye pressure. So you actually could have high eye pressure in both eyes that actually is normal versus one side high and the other side normal is more indicative of possibility
of
glaucoma.
Yes, I get it. Hey, I'm really glad that the test to figure out what your eye pressure is has changed over the years. That puff of air has gone away and now it's just something that's... I don't know. It's an instrument that's actually just touched on the surface of your eye.
Yep, it is. Some people still use the air puff test. On the one hand, we don't use it as much because people know it's coming, so then they squeeze. So, for example, this patient that called with high eye pressure might have squeezed, and it could have been a little bit high, versus the touch test is a little bit nicer because people don't squeeze as much.
But again, there's nothing you can really do to... In addition to his yearly checkups, is there anything he can do if he has this high pressure?
So things that can raise eye pressure, one thing that can is oral prednisone can do that. So steroids can do that, inhaled steroids. But really there's nothing that he can do in regards to diet, those kind of things. Main thing is to get it rechecked.
Rachel in Eau Claire is with us. Hello, Rachel. Hi, Rachel. Are you on? Are you there?
Hi, I am. Yeah.
Hi.
Hi, I am a photographer. I'm 21 years old, and I spend a lot of time doing photography, and I've noticed recently that one of my eyes, the one that I leave closed most of the time as I'm shooting, gets a little blurry, and that blurriness lasts for 10 or 15 minutes even after I'm done, and sometimes I worry that it's not going to go away. And I was just wondering if that blurriness is anything to be worried about or if it's anything that could eventually be lasting.
Well, first off, nothing takes the place of a good eye exam. So I would get your eyes looked at, make sure everything is doing well. Intermittent blurriness, especially when you're concentrating, lots of times is actually dry eye. Because what we're doing is we're staring. When we stare, we actually, the outside tear layer starts to evaporate. Does it ever get better when you blink, or does it usually take a full 10 minutes to get better?
The blinking sometimes works a little bit, but it usually takes a little time.
Okay, well, I would get your eyes looked at just in case, but if you wanted to, in the meantime, take some artificial tears 2 to 4 times a day, that might help solve your problem as well.
Okay.
All right, thank you, Rachel. Good luck with that. Let's go next to Patrick in Madison. Hello, Patrick.
Hey, Joy. Hey, Dr. Canock. Thanks
Hello.
For the show. Very informative. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Just have a quick preventative question. I consider my eyes to be fairly normal as far as aging. When I was 40, I started losing vision for reading and then eventually lost my long-distance sight as well. At least it was less effective. Eventually went to reading glasses and then moved into soft contact, which is what I'm doing now, the extended wear soft contacts. And I'm just loving them. I wake up, I have them in my eye for extended periods, as long as 30 days. Never take them out, and I love them. I guess I'm wondering, preventative-wise, am I okay to it almost seems too good to be true.
So the honest answer is we do not recommend people wearing their contact lenses overnight. Now, I know that you know, you see all the commercials on TV and those kind of things, and technically it is something that the manufacturer says you can do, but we never advocate people sleeping in their contacts. The reason why is because when you sleep, you have wonderful dreams, you're dreaming about things, and your eyes are moving around, and you can get small little paper cuts in your eye. And most of the bacteria that kind of live on us and near us can't get through the outside layer of the cornea unless they have a paper cut. So we never advocate people sleeping in their contacts. You can certainly talk to your eye care provider, but if it was me, I would actually take them out when I go to bed and then put them back in the morning.
Sorry, Patrick.
I found that I had such, taking them on and in and out, it caused so many additional eye discomforts that mm-hmm. leaving them in just remained just amazingly comfortable. And I guess I'm struck by your answer, and I appreciate it, understand it, but I know taking them in and out always created kind of a discomfort on the other end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it really matters on what types of patients. So I'm an eye surgeon, so we see lots of the bad corneal ulcers, those kind of things, where people have been wearing their contacts overnight. You know, you can talk to your eye care provider, get an opinion, those kind of things. Certainly the manufacturer would agree with you doing what you're doing, but in the end, since we see lots of bad disease, I would never recommend you sleep in your contacts. Yeah.
Thanks, Patrick. Joe in Central Wisconsin. Hi, Joe, you're on the air.
Hi there, Joy and Doctor.
Hi.
I was diagnosed a year ago with a disease that I don't remember the name of, but it was NAION.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do, Dr. Parsa down in Madison diagnosed mm-hmm. it.
Yep.
After my local ophthalmology department and neuro-ophthalmologist couldn't figure anything out. And basically what he said, it's very similar to what you described, where the retina gets torn as that vitriol pulls away, but mm-hmm. it happens to the optic nerve instead of the retina.
Yeah.
Well, why don't, Joe, we're running short on time. Dr. Canuck, what exactly is that condition?
So what he said was an acronym, NAION, which stands for non-arteritic ischemic optic neuropathy. Lots of doctor words in there.
Mm-hmm.
But basically what that means is that the optic nerve did not get enough blood supply. So there are certain medications that can lead to that. Blood pressure issues can lead to that. Typically, it happens when we awake where we just don't see well and the optic nerve is swollen. So very different than the retinal diseases we've talked about. That's actually trouble with the optic nerve. Mm-hmm. So staying away from things that decrease the blood pressure overnight, like taking blood pressure medicines at night, is very important, and seeing his eye doctor like he did.
Yeah. Well, we only have a minute to go, Dr. Canuck. What advice do you have to leave us with when it comes to our eye care?
Mm-hmm. I think the main thing is make sure you see your eye care provider. Make sure that you have a good baseline exam so that everything looks good. Simple things like good diet, those kind of things are perfect. Wearing your sunglasses. And I think one thing we didn't talk about is trauma. Make sure you wear your safety goggles, those kind of things, when working outside in the yard and around the house.
Will do. All right. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Dan Canuck is an ophthalmologist at UW Health and assistant professor of ophthalmology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We'll try to get him back for another exam within the year. How's that? Thanks very much to Bill Martins for producing this program. Thanks to Christy Taylor for on-air direction and Robin Cherry for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.